Chapter 100. Bill, are you interested in coincidences? After discovering, about the middle of the book, that Kathy was Susie Clemens, I put her picture with my MS to be reproduced. After the book was finished, it was discovered that Susie had a dim model of Soldier Boy in her arms. I had forgotten all about that toy. Then I examined the cat picture and laid it with the MS for introduction, but it was not until yesterday that I remembered that one of the cats was named Buffalo Bill. Sincerely yours, Mark. The reference in this letter to shrinkage of his handwriting with the increasing intensity of his interest, and the consequent addition of the number of words to the page, recalls another fact noted by Mr. Danica, viz. That because of his terse Anglo-Saxon diction, Mark Twain could put more words on a magazine page than any other writer. It is hardly necessary to add that he got more force into what he put on the page for the same reason. There was always a run of reporters at Mark Twain's New York home. His opinion was sought for on every matter of public interest, and whatever happened to him in particular was considered good for at least half a column of copy, with his name as a catch line at the top. When it was learned that he was to spend the summer in New Hampshire, the reporters had all wanted to find out about it. Now that the summer was ending, they began to want to know how he had liked it, what work he had done, and what were his plans for another year. As they frequently applied to his publishers for these details, it was finally suggested to him that he write a letter furnishing the required information. His reply, handed to Mr. Danica, who was visiting him at the moment, is full of interest. Mem. For Mr. Danica. Dublin, October 9, 1905. As to the other matters, here are the details. Yes, I have tried a number of summer homes, here and in Europe together. Each of these homes had charms of its own, charms and delights of its own, and some of them even in Europe had comforts. Several of them had conveniences too. They all had a view. It is my conviction that there should always be some water in a view, a lake or a river, but not the ocean, if you are down on its level. I think that when you are down on its level, it seldom inflames you with an ecstasy which you could not get out of a sand flat. It is like being on board ship, over again. Indeed, it is worse than that, for there's 3 months of it. On board ship one tires of the aspects, in a couple of days, and quits looking. The same vast circle of heaving humps is spread around you all the time, with you in the center of it, and never gaining an inch on the horizon, so far as you can see. For variety, a flight of flying fish, mornings. A flock of porpoises throwing somersaults, afternoons. A remote whale spouting, Sundays. Occasional phosphorescent effects, nights. Every other day a streak of black smoke trailing along under the horizon. On the one single red letter day, the illustrious iceberg. I have seen that iceberg 34 times in 37 voyages. It is always the same shape, it is always the same size, it always throws up the same old flash when the sun strikes it. You may set it on any New York doorstep of a June morning and light it up with a mirror flash, and I will engage to recognize it. It is artificial, and it is provided and anchored out by the steamer companies. I used to like the sea, but I was young then, and could easily get excited over any kind of monotony, and keep it up till the monotonies ran out, if it was a fortnight. Last January, when we were beginning to inquire about a home for this summer, I remembered that Abbott Thayer had said, 3 years before, that the New Hampshire Highlands was a good place. He was right, it was a good place. Any place that is good for an artist in paint is good for an artist in morals and ink. Brush is here too. So is Colonel T. W. Higginson. So is Raffle Pumpily. So is Mr. Secretary Hitchcock. So is Henderson. So is Learned. So is Summer. So is Franklin McVeigh. So is Joseph 50. Smith. So is Henry Copley Green, when I am not occupying his house, which I am doing this season. Paint, literature, science, statesmanship, history, professorship, law, morals, these are all represented here, yet crime is substantially unknown. The summer homes of these refugees are sprinkled, a mile apart, among the forest-clad hills, with access to each other by firm, smooth country roads which are so embowered in dense foliage that it is always twilight in there, and comfortable. The forests are spider-webbed with these good roads, they go everywhere. But for the help of the guide boards, the stranger would not arrive anywhere. The village Dublin is bunched together in its own place, but a good telephone service makes its markets handy to all those outliers. I have spelt it that way to be witty. The village executes orders on the Boston plan, promptness and courtesy. The summer homes are high perched, as a rule, and have contenting outlooks. The house we occupy has one. Monadnock, a soaring double hump, rises into the sky at its left elbow, that is to say, it is close at hand. From the base of the long slant of the mountain the valley spreads away to the circling frame of the hills, and beyond the frame the billowy sweep of remote great ranges rises to view and flows, fold upon fold, wave upon wave, soft and blue and unworldly, to the horizon 50 miles away. In these October days Monadnock and the valley, and its framing hills make an inspiring picture to look at, for they are sumptuously splashed and mottled, and detorched from skyline to skyline with the richest dyes the autumn can furnish, and when they lie flaming in the full drench of the mid-afternoon sun, the sight affects the spectator physically, it stirs his blood like military music. These summer homes are commodious, well-built, and well-furnished, facts which sufficiently indicate that the owners built them to live in themselves. They have furnaces and wood fireplaces, and the rest of the comforts and conveniences of a city home, and can be comfortably occupied all the year round. We cannot have this house next season, but I have secured Mrs. Upton's house which is over in the Law and Science Quarter, 2 or 3 miles from here, and about the same distance from the art, literary, and scholastic groups. The science and law quarter has needed improving, this good while. The nearest railway station is distant something like an hour's drive. It is 3 hours from there to Boston, over a branch line. You can go to New York in 6 hours per branch lines, if you change cars every time you think of it, but it is better to go to Boston and stop over, and take the trunk line next day, then you do not get lost. It is claimed that the atmosphere of the New Hampshire Islands is exceptionally bracing and stimulating, and a fine aid to hard and continuous work. It is a just claim, I think. I came in May, and wrought 35 successive days without a break. It is possible that I could not have done it elsewhere. I do not know. I have not had any disposition to try it before. I think I got the disposition out of the atmosphere this time. I feel quite sure, in fact, that that is where it came from. I am ashamed to confess what an intolerable pile of manuscript I ground out in the 35 days, therefore I will keep the number of words to myself. I wrote the first half of a long tale, The Adventures of a Microbe, and put it away for a finish next summer, and started another long tale, The Mysterious Stranger. I wrote the first half of it, and put it with the other for a finish next summer. I stopped then. I was not tired. But I had no books on hand that needed finishing this year except one that was 7 years old. After a little I took that one up and finished it. Not for publication, but to have it ready for revision next summer. Since I stopped work I have had a 2 months holiday. The summer has been my working time for 35 years. To have a holiday in it in America is new for me. I have not broken it, except to write V's diary and a horse's tail short things occupying the mill 12 days. This year our summer is 6 months long, and ends with November and the flight home to New York, but next year we hope and expect to stretch it another month, and end it the 1st of December. No signature. The fact that he was a persistent smoker was widely known, and many friends and admirers of Mark Twain sent him cigars, most of which he could not use, because they were too good. He did not care for Havana cigars, but smoked the fragrant, inexpensive domestic tobacco with plenty of pep in it, as we say today. Now and then he had an opportunity to head off some liberal friend, who wrote asking permission to contribute to his cigar collection, as instance the following. To Rev. 50. M. Powers, in Haverhill, Mass. November 9, 1905. Dear Mr. Powers, I should accept your hospitable offer at once, but for the fact I couldn't do it and remain honest. That is to say, if I allowed you to send me what you believe to be good cigars, it would distinctly mean that I meant to smoke them, whereas I should do nothing of the kind. I know a good cigar better than you do, for I have had 60 years' experience. No, that is not what I mean. I mean I know a bad cigar better than anybody else. I judge by the price only. If it costs above 5 cents, I know it to be either foreign or half foreign, and unsmokable. By me. I have many boxes of Havana cigars, of all prices from 20 CTS apiece up to 1.666 apiece. I bought none of them, they were all presents, they are an accumulation of several years. I have never smoked one of them and never shall. I work them off on the visitor. You shall have a chance when you come. Pessimists are born not made. Optimists are born not made. But no man is born either pessimist wholly or optimist wholly, perhaps. He is pessimistic along certain lines and optimistic along certain others. That is my case. Sincerely yours, S. 50. Clemens. In spite of all the fine photographs that were made of him, there occurred constantly among those sent him to be autographed a print of one which, years before, Serenity had made and placed on public sale. It was a good photograph, mechanically and even artistically, but it did not please Mark Twain. Whenever he saw it, he recalled Serenity with bitterness and severity. Once he received an inquiry concerning it, and thus feelingly expressed himself. To Mr. O. No address, 21 Fifth Avenue, New York, November 14, 1905. Dear Mr. O., that alleged portrait has a private history. Serenity was as much of an enthusiast about wild animals as he was about photography. And when Duchelu brought the first gorilla to this country in 1819, he came to me in a fever of excitement, and asked me if my father was of record and authentic. I said he was. Then Serenity, without any abatement of his excitement, asked if my grandfather also was of record and authentic. I said he was. Then Serenity, with still rising excitement, and with joy added to it, said he had found my great-grandfather in the person of the gorilla, and had recognized him at once by his resemblance to me. I was deeply hurt, but did not reveal this, because I knew Saxony meant no offense, for the gorilla had not done him any harm, and he was not a man who would say an unkind thing about a gorilla wantonly. I went with him to inspect the ancestor, and examined him from several points of view, without being able to detect anything more than a passing resemblance. 8, said Serenity with confidence, let me show you. He borrowed my overcoat and put it on the gorilla. The result was surprising. I saw that the gorilla, while not looking distinctly like me, was exactly what my great-grandfather would have looked like if I had had one. Serenity photographed the creature in that overcoat, and spread the picture about the world. It has remained spread about the world ever since. It turns up every week in some newspaper somewhere or other. It is not my favorite, but to my exasperation it is everybody else's. Do you think you could get it suppressed for me? I will pay the limit. Sincerely yours, S. 50. Clemens. The year 1905 closed triumphantly for Mark Twain. The great 70th birthday dinner planned by Colonel George Harvey is remembered today as the most notable festival occasion in New York literary history. Other dinners and ovations followed. At 70 he had returned to the world, more beloved, more honored than ever before. XLV letters, 1906, to various persons. The farewell lecture. A second summer in Dublin. Billiards and copyright, Mark Twain at year 70, as he called it, paused to look backward and to record some memoirs of his long, eventful past. The autobiography dictations begun in Florence were resumed, and daily he traveled back, recalling long ago scenes and all but forgotten places. He was not without reminders. Now and again there came some message that brought back the old days, the Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn days, or the romance of the river, that he never recalled other than with tenderness and a tone of regret that it was gone. An invitation to the golden wedding of two ancient friends moved and saddened him, and his answer to it conveys about all the story of life. To Mr. and Mrs. Gordon, 21 Fifth Avenue, January 24, 06. Dear Gordons, I have just received your golden wedding tea home, and am trying to adjust my focus to it, and realize how much it means. It is inconceivable. With a simple sweep it carries me back over a stretch of time measurable only in astronomical terms and geological periods. It brings before me Mrs. Gordon, young, round-limbed, handsome, and with her the young bloods and their two babies, and Laura Wright, that unspoiled little maid, that fresh flower of the woods and the prairies. 48 years ago. Life was a fairy tale then, it is a tragedy now. When I was 43 and John A. 41, he said life was a tragedy after 40, and I disputed it. 3 years ago he asked me to testify again. I counted my graves, and there was nothing for me to say. I am old, I recognize it, but I don't realize it. I wonder if a person ever really ceases to feel young, I mean, for a whole day at a time. My love to you both, and to all of us that are left. Mark. Though he used very little liquor of any kind, it was Mark Twain's custom to keep a bottle of Scotch whiskey with his collection of pipes and cigars and tobacco on a little table by his bedside. During restless nights he found a small quantity of it conducive to sleep. Andrew Carnegie, learning of this custom, made it his business to supply Scotch of his own special importation. The first case came, direct from Scotland. When it arrived, Clemens sent this characteristic acknowledgement. To Andrew Carnegie, in Scotland. 21 Fifth Ave. February. 10, 06. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.